Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're cutting straight through the noise of last year's global economy.
And currency markets, specifically.
Exactly. We are doing a deep dive into the Monex USA Annual Currency Outlook, and we're focusing on 2025. What a year.
It really was. I mean, it was defined by protectionism, huge political shifts, and currency swings that just, you know, completely baffled traders.
It felt like the whole system was sort of questioning its own foundation.
It was. The analysts we're reading keep coming back to this one phrase, radical uncertainty.
Radical uncertainty.
Yeah, and what's so fascinating is that the stability we've relied on since, what, World War II? The whole U.S. dollar-led Bretton Woods system is now being actively challenged. And it's all driven by these rapid shifts in trade policy and geopolitics.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Our mission here is to figure out how the U.S. dollar, you know, the bedrock of that whole system, ended up registering its weakest annual performance since 2017.
It's the big question.
How did the king fall so hard? And what does it mean now that tariffs are, well, the new diplomatic weapon of choice?
That's the core tension we have to get into first. The dollar was like a boxer that got knocked out in the first half of the year.
Right.
It fell 9.0% overall. That's according to the Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index, the BDXY.
But the really stunning number is from the first half of the year.
It is. The first 6 months of 2025 were the dollar's absolute worst first half performance since 1973. I mean, just think about the historical weight of that.
1973. Wow. That's when the whole fixed exchange rate system just collapsed.
Yeah.
So what were the haymakers? What landed in that first half?
There were three really critical drivers. First, just intense market speculation over when the Federal Reserve would start cutting rates.
That eroded confidence.
Exactly. Second, the immediate escalation of a new global trade war with higher tariffs. And third, the longest government shutdown ever recorded in the U.S.
And that last one created this fog, right?
Right.
That sort of data uncertainty.
Precisely. If you don't know the economic score, it's pretty hard to trust the economy.
Yet I remember this feeling of whiplash because the dollar did manage to claw back a little in the second half, didn't it?
It did.
It felt so counterintuitive, especially since the Fed did start cutting borrowing costs in September.
It managed a modest 1.0% recovery. And it was surprising, like you said, because it happened even as the Fed was starting its easing cycle.
So what helped it?
Mostly the fact that the U.S. managed to dodge those really serious recessionary fears. Q1 GDP had actually contracted by 0.5%.
Which signaled big trouble.
Big trouble. But then Q2 stats showed this surprising comeback, a really strong 3.0% resurgence.
But the Fed itself wasn't exactly a picture of stability. You mentioned its independence was being challenged. Was the market just reacting to data, or were there political things undermining the Fed?
Oh, it was definitely the latter. Mm. The central bank's independence was challenged directly. And the world saw that as a major threat to the whole system.
I remember that.
Just look at the December 10th meeting. Even after they had started easing, it showed this huge lack of internal consensus. You had two voting members who wanted to hold rates, just ignoring the slowing growth.
And on the other side?
On the other side, you had a new voting member, Steven Marin, who was aggressively pushing for 50 basis point cuts. He was arguing the system needed much faster easing.
So that internal fighting must have screamed instability to everyone watching globally.
It did. And the domestic economic picture, you know, despite that Q2 GDP bump, was still showing some serious cracks.
The labor market, for instance.
The labor market in particular. Initial jobless claims hit their highest level since 2020 in mid-December. And U.S. manufacturing. It shrunk to a 14-year low.
Wow.
That was 10 consecutive months of contraction. That's stagnation territory.
So if we step back, what does this whole year of volatility and challenged institutions, what does it all mean for U.S. dollar supremacy? This loss of faith sounds really profound.
It's the defining shift of this entire deep dive. The numbers on global reserve composition, they really bear this out.
So what are they saying?
USD supremacy is being actively compromised. Think about it. Back in 1999, the U.S. dollar made up 72.0% of global central bank reserves.
72%?
Today, that number is down to 58.0%.
That's a huge drop.
It's a massive shift. It signals that global central banks are genuinely uncertain. They're diversifying because they can no longer just take that stability for granted.
That narrative really sets the stage perfectly for the core mechanism driving all this, which is tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
If the dollar is less stable, nations need new tools. So how did tariffs become this new instrument of diplomacy? kind of replacing financial sanctions?
They've evolved so dramatically. They used to be seen as, just a tax on consumers and businesses.
Right.
But now they are a very precise tool for achieving diplomatic goals,
mm-hmm.
for extracting concessions. They are direct, they're visible, and they are very transactional.
Okay, so let's talk about the rollout. We had Liberation Day, April 2nd.
That day saw the application of a 10.0% blanket tariff rate applied right across the board to almost all goods.
But some things were exempted later on.
They were. Certain items mm-hmm. and USMCA partners. But here's where the analysis gets really interesting.
Okay.
The actual effective tariff rate that importers paid was only 14.0%. That's roughly half of the aggressive 27.0% the White House initially announced.
So the bite wasn't nearly as bad as the bark, but the intention to use this lever was crystal clear.
Absolutely.
And the case study with India really hammers home the transactional nature of this new diplomacy.
It really does. India got hit with a steep 50.0% tariff in August.
And that was for a specific reason.
It was a direct punishment for maintaining ties with Russian oil producers. But they resolved it not through politics, but with a commercial contract.
A contract.
Yeah, they signed a one-year deal committing their state-owned companies to source 10.0% of their LPG imports. That's 2.2 million tons from the U.S. A direct commercial trade for tariff relief.
And this is where it gets critical for you, our listener. This shift away from universal free trade towards these custom deals, it sounds like a massive structural fracture.
It is. The outcome is what the report calls idiosyncratic relationships. Instead of global frameworks, countries are creating these one-off trade deals.
And that fragmentation is what's threatening dollar dominance.
Exactly. Because less global trade is being routed through those big uniform channels. Paradoxically, the U.S. trade deficit is actually the lowest it's been since 2020.
But the system is fragile.
Very. And we can't ignore the big challenge looming. The U.S. Supreme Court is actively weighing the legality of using these tariffs unilaterally. That could upend the entire strategy.
A legal review could just inject a whole new level of instability. Okay, shifting gears. Let's look at the currencies that actually benefited from the dollar's chaos, starting with Europe. The euro seemed almost Teflon-coated last year.
The euro truly outperformed. It climbed over 13.0%. That's its best annual performance in 22 years.
Wow.
Reaching its strongest point against the dollar since 2021. This was more than just USD weakness.
So what were the key internal drivers behind that success?
Well, the eurozone managed to avoid those recessionary fears that were plaguing the US and the UK. It also showed this rock-solid commitment to fiscal expansion.
Especially in defense?
Particularly fueling defense industry growth, which provided a real stimulus. And crucially, the ECB was effective. They brought inflation under control, down to a manageable 2.1%.
And their geopolitics showed a real strategic pivot, didn't they? Prioritizing trade reality.
Exactly. The EU secured a big trade agreement with Mercosur in South America. But the biggest policy reversal was lifting the ban on combustion engines.
The one that was set for the 2030s.
That's the one. They basically admitted it was necessary because there wasn't enough demand for EVs and they needed smooth global trade. They chose pragmatic economics.
Now, across the channel, pound sterling also showed some surprising resilience.
Sterling managed an 8.0% rise, its best year since 2017.
And what's fascinating there is that this happened even as new research was confirming the painful long-term cost of Brexit.
That's right. UK GDP per capita is calculated to be about 8.0% lower, and business investment is 18.0% worse off than if they had stayed.
So the currency strength wasn't an economic miracle, but more of a political reset that calmed the markets.
That is spot on. The new political leadership was all about a reset. It culminated in that May 19th UK-EU summit, which set up a new partnership framework.
And domestically?
Domestically, Chancellor Rachel Rees's tax and spend budget was critical. She secured $22.0 billion in fiscal headroom and lifted the national living wage.
But that sounds like short-term stability. The UK still has some pretty serious headwinds, right?
They absolutely do. Slower production and rising unemployment, which is forecast to hit 5.5%, an 11-year high. That could really challenge sterling strength.
So the Bank of England might have to act.
Economists are already predicting it. They're forecasting at least 225 basis point cuts in 2026.
All right, moving to North America, let's talk about the absolute superstar, the Mexican peso.
The peso's performance was, it was nothing short of stellar. A 15.0% appreciation.
15%.
Its best annual gain in three decades.
So what's driving that?
It's both strategic and financial. First, you have the classic carry trade appeal. The interest rate difference is so attractive that investors are parking their money in Mexico.
And the second driver, is that the big trade shift we've been talking about?
Yes, that strategic shift towards friendshoring and nearshoring. This deepening relationship means Mexico is truly America's most important ally in remaking supply chains away from China.
They're becoming the key manufacturing hub.
The key manufacturing and logistics hub for all of North America.
That partnership sounds really robust, but are there vulnerabilities for the peso ahead?
There are. Their relationship is going to be tested by the timing of the USMCA trade pact renegotiation and, critically, by any U.S. intervention in Latin America.
And domestically.
Domestically, yeah. The peso's strength is already reversing a bit due to rising recession risks and, you know, stagflation concerns inside Mexico itself.
Okay, up north, the Canadian dollar, the loonie, also had a surprising turnaround.
The loonie climbed a respectable 5.0%, its strongest appreciation since 2019.
What drove that?
It was driven by a truly shocking Q3 GDP reading that just crushed expectations. It registered a 2.6% quarterly movement after a big contraction in Q2.
And that reversal paused the Bank of Canada's easing cycle.
It did. They'd seen 4 rate cuts earlier in the year, and that strong data just put a stop to it.
Canada also saw new leadership navigating that complex relationship with the U.S.
That's right. Prime Minister Mark Carney has navigated that friction very carefully. He terminated the controversial carbon tax and, crucially, pledged to meet the 2.0% NATO defense spending target.
But there's a fresh uncertainty looming, and it's coming from oil markets.
Absolutely. The military operation that ousted Maduro in Venezuela is a huge wild card. If Venezuela returns to heavy oil production faster than expected, it could dramatically lower global demand for Canadian petroleum.
A serious competitive threat.
A very serious threat that could undermine the loonie's newfound strength.
Okay, finally, let's turn to Japan, a market that seemed to be swinging wildly, but in the end, just ended flat.
Choppy is definitely the word. Despite those huge swings, the yen concluded the year flat. The big context here was just massive political drama.
The collapse of that long-term coalition.
The 26-year coalition collapsed, which led to the historic appointment of Sana Takaichi, the first woman prime minister.
And she immediately launched new Abenomics. What's the focus there?
It's all about aggressive fiscal spending, specifically targeting investment in high-growth sectors like artificial intelligence and defense.
But there's a problem, right? A conflict between monetary and fiscal policy.
A fundamental conflict. Her huge spending plans are expected to directly counter the hawkishness, you know, the tightening impulse of the Bank of Japan. It could even force them into FX intervention.
So it sounds like Japan is trying to spend its way out of a slump, but the economic reality is just dragging it down.
They desperately need to pick up the pace. GDP contracted by 0.6% in Q3, which took the yearly average down to minus 2.3%, so they have to confront that low growth.
Okay, if we zoom out for our final segment, what's happening in the rest of the world that really solidifies this story of fragmentation and dollar retreat?
Well, the emerging markets are showing surprising collective strength. The MSCI Emerging Markets Currency Index reached a fresh all-time best in June. It appreciated a collective 7.2% for the year.
That's a huge success story. Mm. But why? Why the collective strength?
It's really a combination of two things. First, the growing importance of raw materials and natural energy sources in this new environment.
And second?
Second, there's just increased demand from overseas vendors to be paid in their own currencies. This is leading to more hedging in currencies like the Indian rupee, the Colombian, and Philippines pesos.
And even smaller currencies.
And even trading in what we call frontier tenders, like the Vietnamese dong and the Kenyan shilling.
Mm.
They're finding their own center of gravity, independent of the USD.
So if you're a multinational business, a trader, a policymaker trying to plan, what is the biggest takeaway from this whole deep dive into this era of radical uncertainty?
The core dilemma is simple.
Right.
How do you plan long-term, I mean, further than 6 months out, when the narratives change monthly?
And trade agreements that survived the Great Recession and COVID might not exist anymore.
Exactly. And policymakers have to confront this persistent problem of stagflation, where you have low growth and stubbornly high prices coexisting. It makes the traditional fixes almost impossible.
So what this all means for you, the learner, is that the world is moving towards these idiosyncratic relationships and just higher costs for doing business with America.
Mm.
And that reinforces trade fragmentation and just drastically reduces the global need to invoice and borrow in the U.S. dollar. The divergence is the main story of 2025.
It is. So given that the U.S. is applying unilateral tariffs, often confronting its own allies, while other nations like Japan are focusing expansionary spending on AI and defense, How will this divergence in leadership affect the long-term use of technology and diplomacy?
And ultimately, the big one.
And ultimately, how much longer can the dollar maintain its status as the dominant reserve currency when the system it leads is so actively fragmented? That's the question you should be mulling over as you map out the coming year.